The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hello, I'm Marcus Bella from The Football Ramble. Welcome to the Mixer podcast. This is the sixth episode in an eight-part series to coincide with the release of The Mixer, a book written by one of our panellists, Michael Cox. The story of Premier League tactics from Route 1 to False 9s, of course, out now in hardback, ebook, and audiobook. And Michael is with us once again to discuss the evolution, this time, of number 10s. Hello, Michael.
Hello, Marcus.
We're also joined once again by Will Unwin, a journalist with ITV Sport. Hello, Will.
Hi, Marcus.
Good to have you chaps here. Today we're talking about the number 10 role. Michael, this is arguably the key position in the tactical development of the Premier League.
Yeah, I think so, especially in the early years when, you know, the start of the Premier League, everyone was playing 4-4-2 more or less. And, you know, you had players like Cantona, Bergkamp, Zola, who came into clubs and really transformed the way they play. Manchester United in particular, having previously just been boasted around width and getting crosses into the box. The fact that Cantona was there demanding the ball in central midfield, in advanced central midfield positions just behind the striker, kind of changed the way teams played. They looked to pass the ball through the centre of the pitch, which we forget wasn't really a particular popular route to go in the early years of the Premier League.
Yeah, we liked our wingers in the early years of the Premier League, Will, and to go through the centre was a little bit different. But these number 10s, they're often the exciting players, aren't they? And especially with the likes of Cantona, Zolas and Bergkamps, as Michael was saying there, these were the players that would excite the fans.
Yeah, and I think it helped that the Premier League had more money, and so more came from abroad and had a different football education and a different style, which we'd not seen. It was still very much a rigid 4-4-2, pretty much every team in the Premier League and throughout England. And these players brought something different that you'd occasionally not seen before, like centre midfielder at times, running up and down. But these players could do something different consistently rather than sort of the odd decent cross from some average Man City player of the early 90s.
Will's a Man City fan, by the way.
I'll slag off any other team there. I'm willing to, it's fine.
Oh, okay, right, yeah. Well, we will talk about a certain Man City player in a moment, but Michael, let's talk about Eric Cantona for a minute. Was it fair to say he was the Premier League's first true superstar?
Yeah, I think in hindsight, people can underestimate what a big impact he had. I mean, especially on Manchester United, but then because Manchester United were the dominant team on the league as a whole. This was a time when there were very few foreign players in the league. And the fact that Cantona came over, and as much for his off-field personality as his on-pitch performances, but the two went hand in hand. I mean, he was, in his mind at least, he was something of a philosopher with his strange quotes that didn't quite make sense. But that, combined with the fact he was a different style from almost everyone else in the Premier League at that time, was quite significant. I mean, he, of course, came just before the start of the Premier League with Leeds, played half of the season when they won the title, and then won four of the first five Premier Leagues with Manchester United. So 5 out of 6 years, he won the league. And the only exception was when he was banned for half the year for kicking a fan. Yeah. So basically, if you had Cantona in your team, you won the league.
But also as well, the way Ferguson had to manage him, Will, he was almost a precursor to what we consider kind of modern footballers now, who people say you have to treat them a little bit more carrot than stick kind of approach. And Cantona, I mean, that famous story, you know, when he did kick the Palace fan and in the dressing room after, all Ferguson said to him is, "Eric, you can't do that." I mean, it's just mind-boggling, really. And the other players certainly wouldn't be treated as leniently, if you like. But he kind of was that modern footballer back then when there wasn't so many.
Yeah, you know, Ferguson knew how to deal with every single player, and that was one of his beauties as a manager. And at the same time, he knew that this man was of excessive quality. He was key, as Michael said about the winning record, he was key to all that. And, you know, he said you don't want to wear the club suit to the games, you go ahead, mate. But as long as you're scoring on the pitch, that's fine. And the other players knew that he was the best player in the team and he was the most important man there. And they accepted it. They didn't kick up a fuss like some people may have done recently with the likes of Mario Balotelli, who got treated a bit differently because he was just a bit of a maverick and wasn't producing on the pitch. So there was no payoff there for that, whereas Cantona gave the payoff when he wasn't kicking people in the stands. Superb talents need to be managed a bit differently and need to be given what they can to produce on the pitch. And Cantona genuinely did it. And his goal-scoring record, his assists prove that. And at the end of the day, he's got enough medals in the bank to say what he wants, and he was happy to retire at 29.
Yeah, incredible, really. And you use the word maverick there, which is often quite synonymous with that number 10 position. And whenever someone has the type of skill that the number 10 sort of stereotypically requires, people sit up and take notice no matter where they're from. And someone who featured quite prominently in the number 10's chapter of your book, Michael, was Georgi Kinkladze. And this is a guy from Georgia. Now, at the time, or even now you could say relatively, but at the time nobody knew anything about Georgian footballers or Georgian footballing culture or anything like that. But as soon as he has those skills and as soon as he has that flair, people think, oh, hang on a minute, he's one of these type of players.
Yeah, I think there was definitely a case that everyone saw what Cantona was doing and kind of tried to get their own version of Cantona. And there weren't many in England. And so you had to go to kind of slightly more exotic countries and find players that were more obscure. And I think when you look back, I mean, these days, once you get a foreign player in, they have their own minder. They set them up in a house. They give them a, you know, they sort them out with a car. They do all their electricity bills. I mean, Kinkladze was basically dumped in a Manchester hotel for 3 months, didn't speak any English, didn't know anyone. It was such a risk to kind of gamble your whole side and base your whole side around someone who, you know, for quite reasonable reasons, might not settle in the country.
Will, as a Man City fan, you must love Georgi Kinkladze.
Yeah, obviously, you know, in my upbringing, I'd spent my early time watching a rigid 4-4-2, seeing who could ping it up as quick as possible to Niall Quinn and hope someone was there for a knockdown, which they generally weren't. And if they were, Jerry Craney smashed it wide.
But you're having flashbacks, aren't you?
I might not be able to finish this, but yeah, the PTS is too much. And yeah, we'd never seen anything, you know, like that at City before. He was skillful, intelligent, took players on, which we'd generally had a midfield of Gary Flitcroft and Steve Lomas for the previous few years, and they were decent Premier League footballers, but a man that could do so much different and scored great goals, which were, you know, a rarity at that time. The Southampton goal, I'm sure, stand out to everyone, and he was a huge hero. He was a nice bloke by all accounts. Players were amazed what he could do in training. I remember once speaking to Jeff Whitley, he said that after training, Kinkladze would go set up a tube that had table tennis balls and get the table tennis balls and just smack 9 out of 10 straight in from about 20 yards away. He's just an amazingly talented man, and Franny Lee had spotted him playing for Georgia against Wales by all accounts, and in that game he chipped Neville Southall from about 40 yards. Ooh. And he thought, I want that guy. Went to Dynamo Tbilisi, paid £1.5 million for him. The only problem was with him, he was such a success that Franny Lee thought the best idea now was to sign the rest of the Georgian national team. And we ended up with Kavalashvili, Mirtaz Shalaya and Teskedadze, who all to a man were mediocre at best, but at least Kinkladze had someone to speak to.
Yeah, they were like his player liaisons, weren't they?
Pretty much. It's like when you know, Crystal Palace signed Christian Benteke and signed his brother just to keep him happy. He was such a phenomenal talent that no one else had it in the league, and we were still terrible and went down, there's no doubt about that. And went down from the first division. He'd spent a lot of time out injured and came back and couldn't keep us up despite a superb goal against QPR, which has been overshadowed by Jamie Pollock's own goal in that game, I should say, but I digress.
Well, at least you put the record straight now.
Yeah.
But I mean, with Kinkladze, I mean, as you say, Man City back in those days, very unfashionable side, but here they had their own little superstar who brought in a bit of the exotic, because again, in those days, we didn't know much about football from overseas. We would get Champions League once in a while. And like you said, Michael, a lot of teams wanted their own kind of Eric Cantona, their own special player, and Middlesbrough found theirs in Juninho.
Yeah, I think this is one of the key turning points in the Premier League's development, actually, because You know, you look at Cantona and Bergkamp and Zola, who we're going to speak about in a little while. They've kind of found themselves out of sorts elsewhere, you know, particularly with Bergkamp in Serie A. Zola couldn't get a place in the Parma side, and they kind of sought refuge in England. Whereas Juninho was an up-and-coming talent, and he was given the number 10 shirt for the Brazil national team. He'd just been at Wembley to play against England, and he set up Ronaldo's first international goal. Ronaldo went round, Tim Flowers put it in the net, and everyone was saying, "Cool, this Juninho lad is incredible." He was one of the most promising young players in the world. And the fact that he didn't just come to the Premier League, he went to Middlesbrough, who, you know, again, were an up-and-coming side. So
they went down as well.
And they went down as well. So you've got this incredible situation where basing your team around an incredible talent like that doesn't pay off. I'd even put a lad called Sasa Cercic in the same mould. Scored a couple of wonderful goals for Bolton, but I think they finished bottom. And Cercic just happily said, "Yeah, I'm not a team player." And then that was that. This was the kind of thing you had to accept if you wanted to indulge these mysterious, exotic foreign number 10s.
And often their loyalty was questioned and so on and so forth because, like we say, they were mavericks, they were individuals. And we've often talked about them coming from abroad, but there was one that was sort of homegrown. I mean, from the Channel Islands, certainly, played for England at least. Matt Le Tissier, and his loyalty was very strong because he stayed at Southampton for his whole career. Could have perhaps gone abroad or gone to another Premier League side. The amount of goals he scored and the types of goals he scored, just phenomenal.
Yeah, maybe the most popular player of the 1990s, I'd say, by virtue of the fact that he didn't play for a traditionally big club. So no one really hated him. No one hates Southampton, well, apart from Portsmouth fans. But everyone liked Le Tissier. And interesting thing was that he at Southampton had his best spell under Alan Ball, who is also the manager who took Kincladze to City and kind of built the side around him. So Ball was a real lover of flair players and maybe not one of the managerial greats in Premier League terms, but in terms of giving these wonderfully talented, mysterious number 10's free license to roam, he was quite important.
Le Tissier is an interesting one, Will, because a homegrown talent as well, often accused by so many people as being lazy, which number 10s can be accused of, because again, that it's that maverick feel, isn't it, that he strolls around the pitch and then when he gets the ball, he says, "Oh, I fancy it now," and curls on in the top corner.
Yeah, I think, you know, he's an incredibly talented player that you'd love to have had in central midfield if he could run a bit more, but he didn't want to do that. He's suffered a bit by not being appreciated and not even being a key member of the Southampton team for a while until, as Michael said, Alan Ball said, "You're so talented, we've got to make you the key focus of our team." And he just liked playing football for enjoyment, and that was his key. That's why he didn't move. He thought, "I'm enjoying it here, I'm going to try what I can, because if I score, it's going to be amazing. If I don't, I'm not going to care tomorrow morning." And that was his attitude. And he was the most skillful player Southampton had seen at that time. Again, another unfashionable team with the likes of Ian Dowie, Gordon Watson up top, and someone like Le Tissier, who was number 10 just because he couldn't play anywhere else, really. And his goals were, you know, memorable chips, smashing one in against Tim Flowers from 40 yards, pretty much. And he had that ability, and just one of those people that couldn't fit into the England team as well, because they played a very niche role that didn't fit into the systems that England operated in at the time. And that's why he's probably underappreciated, because he chose not to go to the bigger clubs, and he could never get the more than 8 caps for England. But, you know, Chaffey was a big fan, so that's good enough for me.
Indeed, yeah. I mean, often, sometimes these players are called lazy, and their work rate is questioned, and they're even sometimes called luxury players, Michael. But someone like Eric Cantona, you wouldn't say those two things. And someone like Dennis Bergkamp, you wouldn't call a luxury player.
Yeah, I think very similar in terms of his impact at a particular club. I mean, it's easy to forget that in the first few years of the Premier League era, Arsenal were considered the most boring team of the major teams in the Premier League. They were defensive. They played Ian Wright up front, who was a wonderful player, but they were locating with very long balls in behind. And he was usually partnered by an Alan Smith or Kevin Campbell, John Hartson, you know, a real target man. And Bergkamp came in and, you know, he struggled at first. You know, his first few games, he really didn't get to grips with the Premier League. But I think when he kind of got the hang of it, when he found space between the lines, he changed the way Arsenal played. And I think him, as much as, you know, Wenger came in and revolutionised the way Arsenal did certain things, but Bergkamp was there before him, and he was the one who really changed the way Arsenal played, encouraged them to play through the centre of the pitch, and of course was there for 11 years up until they left Highbury, and was, you know, I think sometimes people underestimate the fact that he did have off games, and he did have some seasons where he didn't contribute much, but I think he stays in the memory for so long because he provided some of the best moments in the Premier League. The goal against Leicester, the goal against Newcastle, just did astonishing technical things with the football.
Yeah, he was a gloriously talented player and will be fondly remembered. And as Michael says, did things with the ball that people couldn't even imagine. And a similar player to Bergkamp as well was Gianfranco Zola, of course, went to play for Chelsea.
Yeah, and at that time, someone of that stature, very small individual, you'd sort of think, whatever he does, he can't get the better of these robust centre-halves that English football has created for the past 50 years. But he was so phenomenal on the ball. His low centre gravity helped him, obviously. His goal against Norwich, I think, will be the most memorable, where he flick in off the corner. He was part of a majestic foreign team, basically. Hullet came in, Viali came in, and it was a different brand of football that suited the likes of him, and that's why he probably did better than like a Kingsclad's Ingenino, who were in terrible teams, just sort of trying to do their bit and make a name for themselves and get a move, probably. There's no denial that he was a superb footballer and a terrible football manager.
Michael, there was something of a dearth of great number 10s during the first few years of the 21st century. Why do you think that was?
Well, I think Bergkamp and Zola and Cantona found it so easy to excel in England because we weren't used to players in that mould. We did get used to players in that mould and we kept it tight between the lines. We worked out how to deal with them. So I think there was less emphasis upon playing through one particular player in that mould. And there's also a shift away from that kind of formation as well. There was a shift towards 4-3-3. You know, Jose Mourinho's team of his first couple of seasons at Chelsea had no room for a number 10. You know, someone like Joe Cole had to reinvent himself as a wide player. So, yeah, there was almost just a different way of playing football. And it was a slight shame when you consider how many great moments, you know, the likes of Bergkamp, Cantona, Kingsley, they were kind of always the goal of the month scorers. They were the players who were providing the best moments. But we didn't really see that in the kind of mid-2000s. And I think that's when football was probably at its most defensive in the Premier League era.
Yeah, we saw the rise perhaps of the number eight position, if you will. Yeah. And yeah, number 10s with one up front, Will, which became very, very popular. Still is, of course. Less room for a number 10 playing just off them.
That allowed for the number eight, as you said, the people bursting into the box, playing off the knockdowns and the little bits of scraps from having two wingers and, you know, a centre forward. I think with those formations, you were left without that luxury of a player. You couldn't have a Makélélé and a number 10. Your team wouldn't really function properly. You'd just have a straight line of midfielders. And even with my limited knowledge of tactics, I think that's why I'm here, you're not going to function as a football team. Teams won the league like that, and probably they were quite fearful at the same time that a number 10 would be marked out of the game by your Makélélés and your defensive midfielders because they wouldn't have the space to move into, and they saw it as a bit of a redundant position when teams were a bit more rigid, I'd say, and there wasn't that luxury to have someone that could go in there and try and create chances. You had to be a bit more settled in your makeup.
Michael, where does Wayne Rooney fit in to this chat? Because some people have him kind of as a number 10. Does he play a bit further forward? Where would you see Rooney in here?
I think his certainly over his career, his average position would be as a number 10. I mean, he's played as the number 9. He's played deeper in midfield. He's played on both flanks at times. I think naturally he is a number 10. I think his best performances have usually come from that position. We kind of treat Rooney as if he's slightly underachieved. He hasn't fulfilled his potential. But to be the record goal scorer for Manchester United and England is an absolutely staggering achievement. And he's just been the type of player who I think has won goal of the season three times. Mm-hmm. Just a player who provides extraordinary moments. Finds it more difficult, I'd say, than someone like Cantona to constantly influence a game. And that's why maybe people have gone off him in recent years. But in terms of goals and indeed the quality of goals, you know, an incredible player.
I mean, Rooney was a great mix. You know, vintage Rooney was a great mix of real kind of British grit, but also a little bit of continental flair, Will.
Yeah, he's superb on the ball. In his early days, he was very much a dribbler, running at defences, and people were scared of him. And he had that extra yard of pace, which obviously he's lost. And he's a bit of a victim of time that, as with anything, as you know, in this social media world, you're only going to remember what's happened in the past week, and he's been pretty poor for the past 3 years, so that's not helping. But yeah, he had the passing, he had the intelligence that is underrated. His game intelligence, for a man that was widely criticised early on for being a bit thick, is incredible, and he knows how to play the game. He can picture the game. He knows where most players are on the pitch, and unfortunately, just through physicality, he's declined a bit. But, you know, his goals were always superb. In the Newcastle volley stands out for me as well. He's just unfortunate that he started off at 16 and he's not managed to keep it going till the age of 31 as he is now, because that number of games is not going to do much for your body. And let's be honest, he's probably not looked after himself as well as he could have. But at his peak, he's the most gifted English forward I think we've had.
Nowadays, Michael, the emphasis on possession football is quite strong, and the dominance of that Spanish tiki-taka, obviously hugely popularised and praised when Pep Guardiola was in charge of Barcelona. And this meant a new type of number 10 arrived in English football.
Yeah, I mean, I found that very exciting personally. I remember when David Silva first came to Manchester City in 2010, a lot of people said, you know, he's a kind of very small, slight, classically Spanish central midfielder going to be able to thrive in the Premier League. And, you know, I think his contribution over the last few years has been exceptional. And you had, after him, you had Juan Mata, who did something similar for Chelsea and then Manchester United, Santi Cazorla for Arsenal. These are like really wonderful players amongst the best in Europe. And, you know, the number 10s we've talked about have been second strikers who needed to play centrally. I think the difference with Silva, Mata, Cazorla is that they can play wide and drift in and have the same kind of impact upon games. And indeed, sometimes that's more difficult to deal with. If you've got a number 10 who's staying centrally, as a central midfielder, you know that that's your man, you're going to track him. But if you've got someone who theoretically should be the right back's man, but is actually coming into the centre of the pitch, you know, that can pull teams out of shape and it can lead to left backs overlapping. And, you know, it works particularly well when you've got teams that hold on to the ball for longer, because you can't drift in if you're playing long ball, because you'll find yourself having to wander back to your position straight away. But, you know, now teams hold on to the ball for minutes at a time. Someone like Silva can influence the game in different zones and the same passing move. And personally, I think Silva's impact upon English football has been quite underrated.
You think that's one of the big changes that has happened to the number 10 position now? It's not just fairly centrally up top. It is dragging players out wide and playing in all different manner of zones, as you say.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and that's something that, you know, in Spanish football they've been used to for a while, but it's been a relatively new innovation in English football.
Yeah, because English football's sometimes been criticised, especially from people abroad, as being a little bit rigid sometimes with its systems. Will, David Silva going to Manchester City, I mean, that must have been an interesting one. Did Man City fans, did they take a while to warm to him or get their head around the way he plays?
No, I think they were very much straight onto it. At the time, he was helped by, so he had a base of De Jong and Barry, so Silva was allowed to do what he wanted a lot of the time. I used to watch him just drifting into space. He'd always find space. You know, he's so small, you might miss him on the pitch as an opposition midfielder. And he'd find space, and the players would know that he'd find space, so he could get the ball as often as he wanted, really. He played out wide at times, and there was a lot of swapping of positions when he did that. But he's such a gifted footballer, he could always do it. And so City fans had not seen someone like that, left-footed, wand of a foot, since King Clancy. And City fans could appreciate someone as good as that. So no, he was straight in. There was no worries. That, you know, usual sort of English attitude again. Oh, he's very small. He's not going to cut the mustard. But yeah, needless to say, he has. And, you know, he's got his own nickname, El Mágico. He's pretty favourable at City.
I can imagine. Forever in the hearts and minds of the Man City faithful. With regards to Wayne Rooney, when he played for England, people sometimes weren't sure whether he should play as a number 9. Was there an option to play him as a number 10? And English football has sometimes struggled to produce those kind of players. Whereas now with that new type of number 10 role, Michael, it is a little bit different. And one player that's emerged recently who's very exciting for club and country, hopefully, as well, as Dele Alli.
Yeah, I think he's a fantastic player. I really like his movement off the ball. He's so good at finding space. His first touch and his ability to kind of receive the ball in the half turn. And he loves getting past defenders as if they're not there by kind of nutmegging them or just kind of sliding past them. And again, I think the fact that, you know, there were certain number 10s maybe 20 years ago who had to play as a number 10. I think Alli can play deeper in central midfield. He's played off the left for Spurs. I'd even argue that he's occasionally played more like a second striker than an attacking midfielder now, because he's so good at exploiting the space just behind Harry Kane's movement. And of course, you know, he's wonderful on the ball. He's scored, he's got into double figures in both his Premier League seasons so far, which is kind of an underrated skill for someone who's kind of still developing his game and is still 20 and still learning. And I think he's a really just a really exciting player for England's future.
And England, yeah, we don't produce too many players like that, so it is good. And do you think over, you know, in the coming years, Will, with so many great examples, that England will hopefully produce more of these types of players?
Well, you've got to hope so. You look at, you know, the youth teams at the moment, the roles at City are filled by people like Brahim Diaz, who's a young Spanish lad, but it's showing that those clubs are more accepting these small diminutive players coming through the ranks. I suspect a lot of the very technical players previously have been dismissed quite early on, thinking, you know, you've not got the physicality for the game. But those roles are open for youngsters at the moment. Sadly, at the top clubs, are probably still filled by a few foreigners like with City. But elsewhere, you know, you've got to look at the likes of Adam Lallana, who, you know, has a very similar skill set. Dele Alli's come through with, you know, from MK Dons. And so you've got to be very confident that, as a footballing philosophy, England are far more accepting of people like that. Even look at England playing three at the back against Germany, that things are changing. It's not as rigid, and these players now have a place in English football. Letizia had 8 caps for England. Even Glenn Hoddle was very much overlooked by England a lot of the time, and he's, you know, that sort of player. Mm-hmm. And so now that the culture's changing, you know, a lot more different styles of football coming in, you've got to hope that those will come through where they may not have done before.
Absolutely, and English football has often been criticised, as we said before, as being a bit rigid and needed to be a bit more fluid, and hopefully that can be the case. As always, Michael, I'm going to ask you to think of who was the real game changer in terms of number 10s throughout the Premier League.
Well, I think it's got to be Cantona, his early impact on the Premier League and almost convincing other teams that they needed their own kind of Cantona in that mould. And then, you know, I think he's responsible as well for the knock-on effect of Bergkamp revolutionising Arsenal, Zola doing the same at Chelsea. And I don't think it's a coincidence that those three teams have gone on to be the three most successful teams of the Premier League era, because they were ahead of the game. They were playing a kind of continental style of football when not many other teams were. And it's that style that has dominated and is now kind of just standard at the top clubs.
Well, you'd probably think David Silva, but you've got to say Eric Cantona's had an enormous impact on the Premier League.
Eric Cantona, the bane of my early years, when City were truly terrible, and my brother, being a United fan, lording it over me, they had a player of quality, whilst I was explaining to him that Niall Quinn's headers were far more impressive than anything Cantona had ever done. But yeah, he was phenomenal. My first game actually was a Manchester derby, and he scored for Man United in a 1-1 draw. Quinn scored the equaliser with a header. And yeah, he was just something different. You know, Mark Hughes was his strike partner at the start, and he was a physical player, and you thought that was what was going to make United successful. No, it was Cantona's skill on the ball and actually having a celebrity character that brought football a bit more into the mainstream, as the aim was with the Premier League and the change to make it more accessible to everyone. It was just, you know, a very enjoyable person to have, and it also having a bit of a mean streak in him meant that you could enjoy them a little bit extra.
There we are. Well, thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Mixer podcast. The Mixer is out now and available in hardback, ebook, and audio book. I'm Marcus Speller. Thanks very much to Michael Cox and Will Unwin for joining me. Please join us next time for our next episode, when we'll be discussing the evolution of the centre forward.